Brett Hayes is Associate Professor of Political Science at Union College. He is our scholar in residence here at WAMC. He's an expert in many areas of American politics. I want to go back to the Supreme Court. Clarence Thomas raised a lot of eyebrows the other day. The last time we spoke, you said he may retire to give the president yet another appointment. Possible. However, he did a little bit of what we could only call obituary, perhaps, I don't know, New York Times versus Sullivan, a staple of American ways of suing the press. You can't do it if you've injected yourself into politics. Oh, of course, you could do it, but people know it's an almost impossible task. You have to prove actual malice and all the rest. So he opened up his yap, I think, suspecting, I suspect that he knew very well that he was the object of a lot of people's scorn, and he'd like to be able to sue him.
Well, so this requires maybe a slightly deeper dive into Thomas's jurisprudence. So Thomas has throughout his career been willing to reconsider long-established Supreme Court precedents due to his commitment to originalism. He is somebody who believes that the Constitution should be interpreted through the original public understanding of the document, and has been, you know, the most principled of any justice in that particular approach, which sometimes leads to some what we might call kind of crazy legal ideas, right? Because they're just simply not embraced by the mainstream. They're not considered ideas that are, to use a phrase that a legal scholar by the name of Jack Balkin said, they're not on the wall. They're off the wall ideas. So, for example, when the 14th Amendment was ratified in 1868, it included a provision called the Privileges and Immunities Clause. And certain of the framers of the 14th Amendment believed that that would apply the first 10 amendments to the U.S. Constitution to the states. However, within a decade, the Supreme Court had ruled that the Privileges and Immunities Clause essentially means nothing. It does not incorporate the Bill of Rights against the states. And so that has been our history. Now, the Supreme Court in the 20th century selectively applied most of the first 10 amendments to the United States Constitution to the states, most of it. And they did that through the Due Process Clause. Well, 20 or so years ago now, I think it's about that long, Justice Thomas, in a concurring decision, said, hey, you know, we may have gotten the Privileges or Immunities Clause wrong back in the 1870s when we interpreted it. And I think we should reconsider this whole thing. Right. That would undo an inordinate amount of the court's jurisprudence throughout the 20th century. And he's, you know, he's open to that because he's saying that if, in fact, we're taking the original intention seriously, we may want to reconsider this. I see his argument about New York Times v. Sullivan in the same vein, that he's willing to throw out these markers. Importantly, he was writing a concurring decision.
Remind everybody, Brad, what the decision basically said.
Yeah, in Sullivan, basically, it said that in order to sue for something like libel, you have to show that the statement was false or was reckless, and the publisher would have to be reckless in deciding to publish that information, you know, kind of without a thorough investigation about whether it was accurate or not. So what it did was it enabled the press to go about its work in reporting on public officials without concern about whether they might make a mistake and then have devastating financial consequences because of even a good faith mistake. Trump obviously has not been a fan of the media, and so he regularly raises this as a way of essentially threatening the media in case, you know, they say things that are unflattering. He'll sue them. Obviously, he's done that kind of throughout his career, threatened to litigate based on any kind of bad press. Well, I don't know that Thomas is really thinking about that so much as thinking about this consistency with history and laying down some markers over the course of his career that history will decide whether he's right or wrong. One of the things that we know about the Supreme Court, one of the, in some ways, the advantages of these written decisions is that, you know, many individuals will write a dissent at some point in time, so not prevailing law, that will later be adopted by the court. And so they look good through the perspective of history. I think Thomas is attempting to do some of those things with his commitment to originalism.
Well, I'm not a big Clarence Thomas fan, but I can tell you, I think that it's an interesting tack to take on New York Times versus Sullivan, because why should somebody who is in the public eye have fewer rights in terms of suing for libel than some guy who's walking down the street? I mean, I think there is a... But what was interesting to me is that while he did write that as a sort of codicil to the decision at hand, no one joined him.
No, that's right. He was alone in it. And much in the way that I had mentioned about him writing his own separate opinion about the Privileges and Immunities Clause, he was alone there, too. So he's been willing to do that, to go out on his own, to stake out some kind of unique intellectual territory to see if it'll be picked up on a later date. But is that likely? No. And I think if we're talking about when we might see somebody pick it up, we're talking about, you know, generations from now, not any time in the immediate future.
I got 2 minutes. I want to ask you about Trump and the border wall. He has a national emergency declaration. It's been voted inappropriate or down by the House of Representatives. Now it goes to the Senate, where Mitch McConnell is saying, we're going to take our time. We have to do it. We have to vote according to the law, but we'll take our time in doing it. What do you make of that?
Yeah, it's a delay tactic, but the statute requires a vote. And so even if it passes the Senate, of course, it'll go to the president for signature. He'll veto it. But where it may matter, since we've been talking about the Supreme Court, is the ways in which the courts evaluate executive power. There's a famous case, the Youngstown steel seizure case, where Albany Law School's own Justice Robert Jackson writes a famous concurring opinion in which he basically creates a way of evaluating executive power. He basically says that when the president acts with Congress's express or implied authority, he's working at his maximum authority and the courts should be the most deferential. When the president is acting where Congress is silent, he's in the zone of twilight. So early on, courts should be deferential, but over time, they should be more and more skeptical of presidential authority. And then lastly, when the president acts in defiance of Congress, the president is acting at the nadir of his authority, and the courts should be the most skeptical. It's entirely possible that courts could interpret the passage of this resolution as an expression of congressional will, despite the fact that it doesn't turn into law, and use that as a way of evaluating executive authority here in a more skeptical frame.
Very interesting. Our guest, as always, has been terrific. Brad Hayes, Associate Professor of Political Science at Union College, and a guy who we consider to be scholar in residence here at WAMC. Union is very lucky to have you, Brad. I hope you know that, and I hope they know that. Great to have you.
Thanks, Alan.